This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello and good evening. This is Gary Clinton talking at ya. All eager to tell you about our show tonight, which is going to start off with an episode of one of my favorite programs, Crime Classics. Now, some people will call this a docudrama. Yeah, I call it that myself. But that's kind of a grand claim, really. I mean, to start off with, you having the person of the host and completely fictional expert, Thomas Highland. There is not, never was, a Thomas Highland. And I do occasionally look into the historicity of the accounts given on Crime Classics, and yeah, they're pretty good generally. Don't stray too far from the facts, but they're not slavish to them either. I can't say too much about tonight's episode, because I haven't really been able to find out anything about the murder of his brother by Supan anywhere near Bombay in the year 1856. But it's a good story. It's a story of brotherly love, sweet sister-in-laws, a little push, and a tiger. Here from January the 13th of 1954 is how Supan got the hook in old Bombay.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Highland with another true story of crime. Listen. That was a beaten iron bailing hook. A native of India named Kanak just plunged it into a bale of cotton. It was his favorite tool. He used it to plunge into logs when he needed logs. He used it to tear up the hard, sun-packed earth when he wanted to plant. And, mighty hunter that he was, he used it to plunge into charging wild boars whenever he wanted to show the fellows how it was done. And when Kanak went to kill his brother Supan, oh, this beaten iron bailing hook was a veritable handy home workshop. So tonight, my report to you on how Supan got the hook outside Bombay.
Crime Classics, a series of true crime stories from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now, once again, Mr. Thomas Highland.
I would like to address a few pertinent remarks to those of you who may never have been in South Konkan province, India. It lies athwart the Western Ghats and the Arabian Sea. In 1856, the time that concerns us, the province claimed many more vultures than it does now. It was a place of contrasts, of beggars and marble temples, of havildars and pakasabs, of monsoon and searing sun, barren fields, jackals, pomegranates, cobra, Englishmen, fakirs, and veiled maidens, and life and death. Now, there lived in this section of the country two brothers, whose names were Kanak and Supan. And on an early April evening, they were consoling each other.
Weep not for our dead father.
That was Kanak, tall and well-formed of sinew, and who could not bring himself to cry over his dead father.
No, I shall not. For he was a good man, and gentle, and he goes to his peace.
That was Supan, brother to Kanak and younger. He couldn't cry either.
See how he burns there on the ghat. The end of a man. The just end of a man. ashes.
The last of the wood, brother. Let us together throw it upon the pile.
Together. Noble thought. Ready?
Together. Now!
He taught us well, our father.
How to be brothers.
To love each other.
I must tell you something.
Then I to you.
Often our father would lead me to the clearing below the tent of the unveiled women, and there he would say to me, whatever betide, love thee
your brother, which is what I wish to tell you.
Then he would pour the oil of blessing on my head and on my shoulders.
And to me.
Brother.
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 Yes, brother.
Our father left no will.
Fret not, brother.
Nor should you fret.
How should I fret when our father left to me all his worldly goods and also the fertile acres near the waterfall?
Poor brother, you are mad with grief.
How can I be mad when I remember so well our father's very words? Supan, he said, to you all my worldly goods and also the fertile acres
near the waterfall, which is what our father said to me. Supan.
Yes?
I am the older.
I was the favorite.
But you're a liar.
You are poison-hearted.
You are a thief.
You are an usurper of your father's will.
Supan.
Yes, brother?
Our father's wealth is mine.
No.
Well, we shall see.
Yes.
Oh, infamous one.
Oh, vulture.
The wealth is mine.
Mine.
And your wife is just like you.
And your wife...
People who were cremating dear ones this evening were diverted by two fighting brothers. It was a macabre scene. Violence in a field of burning bodies. Hate being shouted, names bandied about concerning each other and their wives, and so on for another hour. Then, bloodied and singed, they were separated. Not by onlookers, and not by mourners, but by their wives, who had been told of what was going on.
Come, Kanak. Do not fight with your brother.
Not with your brother, Supan. Come, let us go home.
And they went. And in the tent of Supan, while washing wounds...
I watched. For some time before I came to you, I watched how you fought. And the dancing shadows the flames made on your body were lovely to see.
Lono. Wife.
But close to you now. The bruises on you. Which should heal them quickly.
Lono, Lono.
What of him, husband?
My brother?
Yes.
He says my father's wealth is his.
And did he tell you the other thing?
What?
How he covets me.
Foolish.
I am not one to attract. No? No.
But the names he called you this night...
He has guile.
You tell me the truth?
As long as he lives, he will covet me. He has said things to me of my hair and my ankles in such a way.
He should be dead.
Then we would have wealth, and no one to argue it. And the other thing, what you wanted for so long.
A handmaiden.
A handmaiden. A silently moving handmaiden who would clean our tent and wait upon us. Who would walk in bare feet, and who would wear a jewel at her throat, and hear bells. To make joyous the times of her waiting upon you.
Lono.
Yes?
This is terrible that my brother should covet you.
He should be dead.
Yes.
It is very logical, Kanak. Huh?
Careful how you bathe my shoulder.
The pain will pass. But what has happened tonight cannot. It is very logical...
Always you say it is logical. What now is logical?
That in some way you should arrange the passing of your brother.
Huh? What do you speak of?
It is written.
A thing is either logical or it is written. Now what?
It is written. Sons are brothers only when a father can keep them away from each other.
What fool wrote that? What... Gentle. gentle woman.
Then listen to me. It is logical that since there is no will, your brother, your younger brother, can legally claim half of what should be yours.
Well, he's done that already. That's why we've fought.
And will you keep fighting and screaming at each other while the fertile acres near the waterfalls turns to weed? Or will you be rich?
Huh? And if I be rich?
It is logical you will be able to afford what you dearly want.
Truly?
A handmaiden.
A handmaiden.
It is written, a man's tent needs two women. A wife to heal the hurt and love. A handmaiden to carry goat's milk.
Yes. Yes, yes.
Well?
It will be pleasant to be rich.
I know.
You must admit both brothers had a pretty busy day. Father dead, taking him out to the Gats, burning him, fighting over his possessions, then home to wives who whisper murder in their respective ears. No wonder they didn't sleep. They tossed all night on their pads, and it wasn't until almost dawn...
Hush, Kanak. Hush.
And down the street...
Sleep, Supan. Now sleep.
And morning came, hot and bright, and over it hung the vultures and the smoke from funeral fires. And in the fields, Kanak was piling bales of cotton with... That's right, the beaten iron baling hook. Piling high the cotton and thinking about what happened yesterday. Thinking about it so hard that...
Snake.
That one would say it had gotten the better of him.
Vulture. Crawling.
Cool, brother.
What?
With such vigor you attacked the cotton, you did not hear me approaching.
What do you do here in the fields?
I came for my spinning to ask you to walk with me.
Walk?
I've been thinking about yesterday, and I want to talk with you.
All right. Let's walk.
Need you take along your hook?
Well, in case a wild boar attacks...
6 months have passed and there have been no boars. Leave your hook, brother.
Oh, very well, brother. Let us walk.
Toward the waterfall.
Good.
Brother.
Yes?
We should not quarrel.
No.
We are brothers.
Yes.
And these fertile acres should belong to both of us.
Indeed.
It would be wisdom.
Hey, do you speak in truth?
We are brothers.
Yes.
Could I have a serpent's tongue when I speak of brotherly things? I would not be worthy then of the name brother.
Nor I.
Let us walk then with arms about the shoulders as brothers do.
Yes. Young brother.
Old brother. And dear to me.
Our father must be proud seeing us now.
Yes. Brother?
Yes.
Look at the waterfall.
Our esteemed waterfall. See how its spray makes a rainbow and...
Kanak. Brother?
Yes.
Let us contemplate the rainbow-making waterfall.
I want to.
You stand here.
Oh, where will you stand?
Here.
Near...
The edge where I can watch you be washed by the river and be carried to the sea. And so to me, you are now a widow. My brother Kanak, your husband, fell from the heights into the torrent of the waterfall.
Oh.
Nor should you weep, for as he fell, he cried your name.
Oh.
And though he could not hear it, I yelled to him that I would always take care of you, my brother's wife.
What will you do with me?
I have discussed it with my wife, and we have concluded...
What will you do with me?
I am rich now.
Oh.
A handmaiden is wanted in my tent.
Oh. Kanak.
Why do you look beyond my shoulder and call to him? He is dead. I saw him myself fall into the...
It was Kanak, all right. Beaten iron, bailing hook in hand. A rather wet Kanak, but certainly not a drowned one. Not a dead one. But his brother was dead. This is known as turning the tables. You are listening to Crime Classics, and your host, Thomas Hyland. Your contribution of $10 or $6.95 for the budget relief package will send more relief overseas than the same money spent any other way. To help people in foreign countries with food or clothing, send your check to Nonprofit Care, New York. That's Care, New York. Send your check, your name and address, and full particulars about who's to get the package. Care will do the rest. And now once again, Thomas Hyland and the second act of Crime Classics, and his report to you on how Supan got the hook outside Bombay. The spring of 1856 in South Konkan province, India, was a good one. The season was fair for the cotton and the butternut. The grain was gold almost to the sea, and the hives were overflowing. And it was this spring, you'll remember, when Lady May Smallwood appeared briefly on the pages of history to make her mark in Indian affairs, only to disappear with her secrets up the Khyber Pass with a wave and a smile never to be heard of again. And it was this spring when Kanak bludgeoned his brother to death with a hook. Now, Kanak was no fool, for, as he told his wife,
"If the authorities find out, they'll hang me."
"Then see to it that they don't."
Good advice. And Kanak was a man who heeded good advice. So, within an hour after he'd committed murder, he presented himself to the mayor.
"Have you paid your taxes, Kanak?"
Which was always the mayor's opening gambit. For collecting taxes was the mayor's chief duty, and to this particular mayor, duty was an obsession.
"Good. What brings you to me?"
"Yesterday, my father died."
"I know."
"I will inherit."
"You will inherit. And your brother?"
"Today, my brother died."
"Oh?"
"He knelt in the field, and a tiger sprang upon him."
"A tiger?"
"A tiger.
I have heard that tigers do spring upon those who kneel in fields when tigers are about, and who are hungry or who have become frightened."
"A huge tiger with great talons and foam-flecked muzzle. An angry tiger."
"What angered him?"
"Who knows the way of tigers?"
"Who indeed?"
"We were speaking, my brother and I, and my brother knelt to pick a pebble that had lodged in his sandal."
"Which frightened the near-passing tiger?"
"The huge near-passing tiger."
"And made the beast angry?"
"Caused him to make terrible roar."
"And spring?"
"And with one blow nearly sever my brother's head."
"And so killed him?"
"Yes."
"Bow not down your head, Kanak. Lift it up and tell to me of the fertile acres by the waterfall."
"They are mine."
"So many acres."
"Some people may doubt my story of how my brother died."
"I have heard so fertile are your acres that one need but throw the seed upon the earth and it flourishes and brings riches."
"Some may say like this, we saw no tiger, we heard no tiger."
"Then they would be wrong, for I heard a tiger."
"How perceptive you are."
"And saw him carrying your brother between his jaws."
"A huge tiger."
"Oh, do not recall the hugeness of him. I tremble."
"Oh, for the fright I caused you, a gift."
"The quarter section south from the stream. Did I pluck the words from you?"
"Wise mayor. My brother, my poor dead brother, is for some reason at my house now."
"I will see he is not there for long."
"Then I go with my grief."
"Go then."
the good of the village, according to the mayor in later testimony. That's the only reason why he'd made such an arrangement. For, should word drift down to the authorities that foul play was suspected, the whole village would have been packed up and moved to Bombay and held for questioning, which is the way things worked in those days. The animals would have been untended, the fields unwatered and seared by the sun, and who would look after the shops? In effect, the questioning over, the village would hardly be worth coming back to.
With this in mind, I made the foregoing arrangement with Cannock.
But why did you accept a bribe of the quarter section south of the stream?
For the good of Cannock, so that he would have a quarter less to worry about.
Didn't you suspect that he might have murdered his brother?
Let he who suspects others suspect himself. For so it is written.
Cannock, having made an arrangement with the mayor, he, Cannock, had another arrangement to make. He went to the home of his brother to seek out Lono, his brother's wife. She wasn't there. So he followed the smallest footprints in the warm dust. And eventually...
I did not mean to startle you, sister-in-law.
The way you swooped upon me.
I didn't swoop.
As I wash my hair in the stream.
Do it.
What?
Your hair in the small current of the stream.
Why?
Beautiful.
If your brother Supan heard you speak so to me...
He cannot.
To speak to me so, to say I'm beautiful? Do you think me beautiful?
I can say so now, and your husband will not hear.
How can you be sure?
He is dead.
Oh.
A huge and hungry tiger sprang upon him.
A tiger?
Ask the mayor.
And if I did, what would he say?
That a huge and hungry tiger sprang upon your husband and killed him.
Cannot.
Yes.
What will become of me?
Oh, poor widow.
What will become of me?
Now that I am rich, my tent needs a handmaiden.
Oh.
I have discussed it with Tumi, and she has said a handmaiden is needed.
It is written a man's tent needs two.
I know. Handmaiden.
Yes.
Cannock! Cannock!
What?
Cannock!
Someone calls.
Cannock! Oh, Cannock. It is well I have found you before it is too late.
Too late? Too late for what?
The policeman has come.
Policeman?
Britisher from Bombay. On his inspection tour.
Inspection tour?
Lono, tell him what I have said. To me, he but repeats and does not react.
The British policeman has come from Bombay on an inspection tour.
And?
Already he has heard that your brother is dead.
Of course my brother is dead, clawed by a huge...
Cannock?
Yes.
The quarter section is not enough.
A half section, then.
All of it.
All the fertile acres?
All. Else. Well, tigers.
Very well.
What you say is quite true, Mayor.
As you will see, it was a tiger. Claw.
Pity. Pity, pity. A chap who doesn't know any better but to turn his back on a tiger. How big did you say? Oh, my.
The broken grass here is the path of the tiger as he carried the poor man to the clearing.
Quite. Quite.
Who knows about tigers?
Oh, I do.
Who knows about tigers, indeed?
I said, I did, old chap.
Oh?
Oh, yes, yes, quite a studier of tigers. I am habitat, manner, etc. Oh, yes.
What brings you to our village, Major?
Passing through, old boy, just passing through. Now, what is it you wanted to know about tigers, old chap?
Will you be coming back next month?
Steady beggars, tigers.
Major?
Desert their mates when the cubs come. They're good swimmers, though.
Major?
It hardly ever attacks a human unless it's an old fellow. This tiger you saw must have been an old beggar.
But huge. Oh, and here he is, Major. Supan, the man who was struck down by...
And pity. Pity.
You see here the force of the tiger's blow, the depth...
Pity. Well...
Yes?
You make your arrangements, old boy. I've seen enough.
We will mourn Supan as he burns on the ghats tonight.
Yeah, I'm sure of it.
Let us go back to the village then, and we will have some tea.
I'll have some. The most remarkable time of an Indian day, don't you think so, old chap?
Yes, I do. Mm.
Paddling into it like this. Mayor?
Yes, sir.
The population of your village, please.
312.
Mayor?
Yes?
A very huge tiger.
Do not recall it.
And old.
Oh.
Mayor?
Oh.
There hasn't been a tiger in these parts for 5 years.
Sir,
not one of those striped beggars in 5 years. I know. This area against the Arabian Sea has been shot clean of tigers, driven them inland. I know. A student of the chaps, you know. Well, here we are.
Sir,
that chap there throwing more wood on the ghat, he would be...
Karnak.
I'll wait here.
Sir, I was only...
Of course. Of course you were.
Wait here. Karnak.
Mayor. Oh, grieve with me, Mayor. Grieve with me.
Murderer.
What?
Murderer.
Well, what of our arrangement?
You struck your brother down with a bailing hook.
But our arrangement...
Murderer! You are under arrest. Come. Get in. Here he is, sir.
That tiger thing, ridiculous, you know. There hasn't been one in these parts for 5 years. Went inland. Sorry, old boy.
Karnak was taken to Bombay, and the rest of the village, too. So eager were the townsfolk to get back to their town that each one pointed an accusing finger at Karnak. He was found guilty. He was hanged. He was sent back to the village. He was burned on the ghats. It is interesting to note that 3 weeks later, Karnak's wife, as she bent over to pick a pebble out of her sandal, was carried off by a tiger and eaten.
In just a moment, Thomas Hyland will tell you about next week's crime classic. Supan, tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. Music was composed by Bernard Herrmann and conducted by Wilbur Hatch. And the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Hyland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. In tonight's story, William Conrad was heard as Canuck, Byron Kane as Supan, Lillian Baeff as Lono, Jack Crucian as the mayor, Julie Bennett as Toomey, and Alastair Duncan as Major Ellison. Bob Lamont speaking.
Oh, I'm sorry to do this to you, but we'll get right back to our programming in a moment. The second episode is from the Canadian series Nightfall, and it's called Special Services, which originally aired on October the 10th of 1980. Nightfall was primarily a supernatural kind of slash horror series, which occasionally ventured into other genres, like science fiction, mystery, fantasy. The series was one of the most popular shows in CBC radio history, running out to about 100 episodes, featuring a mix of original stories and adaptations of both classic and sometimes obscure short stories. Time is an original presentation about a reluctant couple who are on their way to visit a sick aunt who are run off the road by an ambulance. That might seem like a stroke of good luck. I mean, an ambulance is able to take them straight to the hospital. And at first, it does seem like a good stroke of luck. They're going to a special services hospital, which claims to treat only the elites of society. But pretty soon, the wife begins to suspect that the doctors are lying about the sudden demise of her husband in the operating room. Well, everything ain't Jake. Do you know that expression? Everything is Jake? It means everything is satisfactory. It means everything is okay. In this hospital, things are Jake, but they're not okay.
From National Public Radio, NPR Playhouse presents Nightfall.
In the dream, you are falling, lost in the listening distance as dark locks in. Nightfall. Good evening. Tonight we're going to take especially good care of you. All we ask is that you make sure that everybody gets what's coming to them. The play by Martin Kinch is called Special Services.
Ms. Catton?
Speaking.
Ms. Catton, you probably don't remember me. Name's Jake. I live up here north, up by your aunt, Estelle. Along the fourth line?
No.
Well, it's no matter. It was a long time ago we met. I wouldn't even be calling you now if it wasn't for your aunt.
Well, is something wrong?
Let's put it this way, Ms. Catton. I don't know for sure. I mean, I know she's sick. I mean, I wouldn't be calling you if she wasn't.
Well, can't you be a little more specific?
Specific, you want, eh? Well, I figure if you want to see her again, you'd better get up here.
What do you mean? Can I talk to her?
She don't have no phone, Miss Catton. Don't believe in it. She wouldn't even let them take her to the hospital.
But, just a second. I need some information.
Miss Catton, I don't have no more money for this. I said what I gotta say.
But listen, no, we were just leaving on a vacation. My husband... Look, I know this sounds callous.
Miss Catton, your aunt is dying.
I'll be right up.
That's what I thought you'd say.
And Jake, I'll pay you for the call when I get there.
Right, Miss Catton. I'll be expecting you. Yeah, I'll be expecting you. And your husband, you can pay me when you get here. Yes, ma'am.
Same place we are.
Well, if they are, I wish they'd let me know.
Every time I think of those empty seats flying to Barbados, I...
Look, I'm sorry, Jim. It's not my fault.
Yeah, I know.
God's sake!
Well, you want to get there, don't you?
In one piece, if possible.
Yes, ma'am.
Let's stop fighting, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I know it's crazy, but...
No, but, Diane, it is crazy. Really crazy. We could be flying south for my first vacation in 4 years. A vacation which, incidentally, my doctor recommended. But we're not, are we? No, we're...
Jim!
We're driving into the land of the midnight sun. Oh, because some old codger, whatever his name is.
Jake.
Mm-hmm. Even the name sounds phony. How do you know this isn't all a practical joke?
If you don't relax, we're never going to make it down south.
I'd be a lot happier if we knew who this Jake was.
Jim.
I know. Relax.
No. Listen.
You don't suppose your aunt started an epidemic, do you?
It's not funny. You know, that's the fourth ambulance in the last half hour.
How do you know it's not the same one going around in circles? You sure moving fast enough.
You better pull over.
Where?
I don't know.
I can't pull over, Diane. It's sheer rock on both sides.
Now stop this.
Oh, sure. Guy'd run right over me. Now, there's something ahead of us.
Honk your horn, Jim. Jim.
I can't see.
Excuse me. Yes?
What's happening?
Pardon, honey?
With my husband?
Oh, well, he's still in the operating room, honey.
Are you sure? I mean, well, can you check?
Oh, of course. You see? Operating room 3.
But that's impossible.
Honey?
I'm sorry. I mean, I don't understand. We've been here for 7 hours.
These things take time.
7 hours? He was talking to me in the ambulance. He walked in here. He couldn't have been that badly hurt, could he?
Don't worry, honey. Dr. Druitt's the best in the business.
I'm sure he is, but I'd feel a whole lot better if I could see him.
Well, he's not one for small talk. He's, reserved. A bit scary, you know what I mean? But you can bet your boots he's in there doing everything he can.
Yes. I guess it's... I just can't stand the waiting.
I know what you mean.
I don't think you do.
Oh, yes, I do, honey. When it comes to waiting, this place takes the cake. It's so exclusive that... Well, do you know your husband's the first subject I've...
Subject?
Patient. He's the first patient I've processed in a week.
This is a hospital, isn't it?
Honey?
Well, you've got to admit there's something weird. I've been here for hours and I haven't seen a single doctor. Hell, I haven't even seen a nurse. And now you tell me you haven't got any subjects.
Patients. We do have patients.
Where?
Look, honey.
I wish you'd stop calling me honey.
All right, Mrs. Catton. I don't think you realize how lucky you are. This is a special services institution, one of the best in the world. Dr. Druitt does special work for very special people.
Special work?
And it's very exclusive. We have got the most sophisticated equipment. We've got computers linked with the whole world. We can find a kidney, a heart, a liver, anything, anytime, anywhere.
But every hospital's got that.
What?
Every hospital has a computer. I'm an organ donor myself, and so is my husband. Our family doctor, and he's no genius, he told us about it. He never told us about special services, though.
It's no big mystery, honey. It's just that I don't know. Look, We've got patients, okay? We've got one coming in tonight, a real Mr. Biggs. I don't know who he is. If I did, though, and if I could tell you, you'd know him. I mean, you'd know him.
Okay. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm worried, that's all. I'm nervous and edgy. What's that? Battle station?
Admission.
Evening, gorgeous. Where do we take him?
Just a second. Operating room 3.
Right.
Excuse me.
No time to chat now, miss. This here under the sheet's an A-1 priority. Night, gorgeous.
Night.
Who was that?
314-Y26. Other than that, I don't know, honey. Security.
Where is Jim?
I told you.
You told me operating room 3. Then you told him operating room 3. Now, something doesn't make sense.
I must have made a mistake.
I don't think so, Miss Novak.
Honey, I...
First we're run off the road by an ambulance. Then we're brought to this... What is this?
I told you. It's a special services institution. That patient was probably a president of something or a big star.
Miss Novak.
Dr. Cornell, you frightened me. I was just...
Take this tray, please, Miss Novak.
Yes, doctor.
Mrs. Catton, I'm Dr. Cornell.
Yes. How's my husband?
Sit down, Mrs. Catton.
Is he all right?
Will you sit down?
Dr. Cornell.
Mrs. Catton, I'm sorry, Mrs. Catton. Your husband is dead.
What?
I said...
I heard what you said. Look, he walked in here. He was talking to me in the ambulance.
A rib pierced a vital organ.
No. There's something crazy here. Now, I want to see him.
Mrs. Catton, we're working in a very sensitive area. We can't risk infection.
They won't even let me down there.
I thought I asked you to get rid of that tray.
I was only trying to do what I...
Reception...
Mrs. Catton, I wish there was something I could
Don't
say.
Don't you touch me.
Yes, sir. Dr. Cornell, Dr. Druitt would like to see you right away.
Oh, right. Yes, I'll be back.
Doctor, I want to see my husband. And if I don't...
All right. Perhaps in 3 or 4 hours, when we're finished. I mean, when we're finished cleaning up.
The little fake. Thinks he's Dr. Druitt.
I wonder if they use these on Jim.
What?
These instruments.
Well, you shouldn't play with them, honey. You might cut yourself.
There is something wrong here.
Honey?
I don't know what it is, but I think they blew it. He wasn't special enough, you see. I think they're so worried about Mr. Big, they made a mistake, and they killed him.
Oh, that's silly, honey. Dr. Druitt is not the kind of person...
I want to see my husband.
Well, honey... There's nothing I can do.
Miss Novak, either I see my husband now before they clean up the evidence, or I'm going to stick this scalpel in your innocent little face.
Over there.
I can hear him breathing. Where's the light?
I don't know. I told you I've never been in this room before.
Liar.
You're hurting me.
You'll be dead if you don't shut up. You stay here.
What are you doing?
I'm going to try to find the light. There's a door here somewhere.
I'm getting out of here.
No, you're not. Keep quiet.
No, leave me alone.
We should...
just alive. Don't you think if I'm
alive? Jim? God, Jim, you're alive. You're alive.
What's that?
Nothing. I knocked something over. I thought we had better get a doctor.
What?
We might have broken something.
All right. I'll have to trust you.
Okay, honey.
It's okay, Jim. I'm here. I'm here. It's okay. They're not going to hurt you anymore. They're not going to hurt you. God, what's going on here, Miss Novak? Don't you see? They told me he was dead. Miss Novak? Miss Novak? Miss Novak! No! Oh, God! Miss Novak! Oh, Miss Novak, come back! Oh, please! Oh, please, let me out! Please, come back!
Wanted to see me?
Ah, Dr. Cornell, sit down. Do you like music?
I don't have much time.
You should make time, Dr. Cornell. Good for the nerves. Your nerves bad, Dr. Cornell.
I don't think so, sir.
Are you tired? Sick?
No, sir.
And perhaps you can explain why at this very moment Mrs. Catton is blundering around OR3... and our receptionist is attempting to escape from the grounds?
Well,
sit down. You can handle it later.
I guess I didn't... I'm sorry.
You're no diplomat, Dr. Cornell. It's doubtful that you're even a doctor.
Sir?
Sir? My poor boy. Look at that thing, that specimen on my desk, doctor. That useless piece of meat...
But the computer...
The computer, Dr. Cornell, is a tool to be used with discrimination and intelligence.
But
nothing. It's only by the sheerest luck that you haven't botched the whole thing. Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
Good. Now, if you'll follow me, we'll attempt to correct your mistakes.
Yes, sir.
Oh, and doctor, bring that revolting specimen with you.
Don't worry, Jim. We're getting out of here. There's got to be a way, something. We've got to find the light. It's got to be here somewhere. I'm going to find it, Jim.
Not over there, Mrs. Catton.
Who's there?
My name is Druitt. Dr. Jacob Druitt. I'm the director of this hospital.
But you stay away from me.
Shall I turn the lights on, sir?
No, I don't think so. Let's leave Mrs. Catton in the dark for a few more minutes.
But the patient...
The patient is breathing, Dr. Cornell. It's enough.
You mean you can save him?
Of course I can save him. Despite your messy efforts and the stupidities of my assistant.
He told me he was dead.
Yes, Dr. Cornell has made a number of mistakes this evening. I'm sure he's sorry. Aren't you, Dr. Cornell?
I'm sorry.
I'm sure Mrs. Catton forgives you.
Yes, yes, yes. Only please.
Patience. Patience, Mrs. Catton. It may be immodest, but I'm going to enjoy demonstrating my skills at this late hour.
Of course. I'm sorry.
We'll need a little help from you, of course.
Anything.
Shall we have the lights, Dr. Cornell?
That's not my husband.
Very observant, Mrs. Catton.
You said there was a mistake. You said you could save him.
I can save him.
Oh, please, please, Dr. Druid.
Oh, call me Jake. Your Aunt Stella and I, you'll be happy to know she's perfectly healthy.
You... Oh, no. I want to see my husband.
Very well, very well. We'll show you. Dr. Cornell, if you'd just... Yes. Now, Mrs. Catton, if you'd turn your attention to the specimen jar in my assistant's hands, you'll notice that the heart it contains is enlarged.
Oh.
I take it you remember your biology. Now, if you...
Oh, my God.
Oh, dear. She fainted. Pity. Mrs. Catton, awake at last.
Where am I? I can't move.
I'm afraid we've had to strap you down. Now, let's just remove this sheet.
No. No, leave me alone, please. I haven't... You've taken my clothes.
Mrs. Catton, I am a doctor, huh? There. Pretty. Very pretty. Shame, really. Still, you'll be doing your bit.
I don't understand.
Well, it's simple, really. The gentleman in that bed beside you is a very important man. More important than you. Or me. Although, for the moment, he's rather dependent on both of us. Are we ready to sterilize this charming area, Dr. Cornell?
Right away, sir.
No, please, leave me alone. Oh, Jim.
You forget, Mrs. Catton, that Jim is no longer with us.
Oh.
We had hoped to use him for our little rescue job, but, you see, our computer told us to...
Shall I proceed, sir?
Patience. Let us finish our story first. It's the least we can do. Now, your Jim... Well, it's too bad. Still, in the end, it was painless. A favor, really. You see, Jim had heart disease.
We were going on vacation.
Yes, but it wouldn't have worked. He was due for a massive coronary at any moment. Still, an unfortunate mistake.
You mean this is all a computer mistake? No, I don't believe that.
And you'd be right not to. The computer was correct, as usual. Unfortunately, my young colleague is not as detached. He assumed that a male subject required a male heart. Ridiculous. He gets overexcited and has some strange sexist prejudices.
Oh.
Right, Mrs. Catton. Nature knows no such prejudice.
Oh, no.
The heart we wanted was actually your own.
Oh, please, no.
I think we're ready, Dr. Cornell. Doubtful?
No. No. No.
Just heard Special Services by Martin Kinch. Featured tonight were Linda Sorensen as Diane and Bud Knapp as Dr. Druitt. Colin Fox was heard as Dr. Cornell. Marion Waldman as Miss Novak. Gordon Thompson as Jim. And Grant Roll, the attendant. Our recording engineer is John Jessup, with sound effects by Bill Robinson. Script editors are John Douglas and Earl Toppings, with the production assistance of Nina Callahan. Tonight's play was produced and directed by Paul Mills, and the series coordinating producer is Bill Howell.
Thoughtful radio for the world beyond all words. Careful. Of the edge.
Strange Adventure.
A cry of terror went up from the gun deck of the sloop of war. The captain and the lieutenant, who had been talking to the passenger, rushed to the companionway that led below deck. A sight of confused destruction met their eyes. One of the cannon had broken loose, and like a frenzied monster was smashing all before it to rubble. 10,000 pounds of bronze and iron, bent on destroying the ship, was free to work its will. No man, no thing could stand before it. The ship rolled slightly, and the cannon rolled with it, gathering momentum as the deck slanted. Like a demon, it crashed into another gun of the battery, shattering it to bits. Then, as if it had a mind of its own, turned and raced back to smash a gaping hole in the side of the vessel. The gun deck was clear of men, all except one, the man whose cry had given the warning. He lay dead, smashed against the planking of the deck. One of the witnesses of this catastrophe moved. It was the passenger. He elbowed his way between the captain and the lieutenant and descended the ladder to the gun deck, where he stood alone, watching the monster's every move. Then the gun captain came into view. Here was the man responsible for this terrible thing. His was the blame, for it was his task to see that each cannon be properly secured. The gun captain was a brave man, and he came forth now to give battle to this instrument of death. Unarmed, save for an iron bar in one hand and a length of rope fashioned in a noose in the other, he approached. The battle began. Time after time, the man dodged skillfully aside at the very moment when it seemed that he must be crushed to death. Back and forth the fight raged, until at last the end was in sight. The cannon seemed to pause, as though unsure of itself. The man with his back to the bulkhead stepped toward it. Then, like a huge beast of prey, the monster sped straight for the gun captain. He could not move fast enough to avoid it. He was trapped, caught between the cannon and the side of the ship. The passenger, who until now had stood so still as to be unnoticed, came to life. As the cannon hurtled past him, he flung a heavy coil of rope between its wheels. The bronze monster hesitated, ensnared in the hempen coils. The gun captain, quick to take advantage, sprang forward and with his iron bar turned the cannon on its side. He slipped the rope noose over the muzzle and lashed the free end to a stanchion. The monster was subdued. Later, when the damage had been repaired, the crew stood at quarters. The captain turned to the man beside him, the passenger, who was a great general. General, this man who fought the cannon and saved the ship should be rewarded. You, our honored guest, should be the one to do it. The general stepped forward and unpinned the Cross of St. Louis from the captain's tunic. He turned to the gun captain and pinned it on his shirt. For bravery, the Cross of St. Louis. The general paused for but a moment. For carelessness and neglect of duty, death.
This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye from my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of
Strange Adventure.
Truth is stranger than fiction. And this is the proof. This is Ripley's. Believe it or not.
In 1798, Sultan Selim III of Turkey, in the presence of British Ambassador Sir Robert Ainslie, shot an arrow the incredible distance of 2,916 feet, believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you the story of a remarkable woman.
Raise your hand. You got it.
Raise your hand.
You know it. You feel confident, secure.
Raise your hand.
You feel dry now.
Raise your hand.
You know why now.
Raise your hand.
You've got it. That sure, secure, confident feeling. Because each sure gives you enough protection to help feel dry all day.
Confident, confident, dry and secure. Raise your hand if you're sure.
Lucy Page of Tamworth, New Hampshire, certainly exploded the theory that women are the weaker sex. In addition to doing all of her regular housework, she cared for two cows, made all the clothing for her family, spun 200 skeins of wool yarn and 45 skeins of linen yarn, wove 90 yards of carpeting, made 69 yards of flannel and 21 yards of toweling. And she did all of this at the age of 73, believe it or not.
For the science fiction segment tonight, we're going to turn to Jack London's 1912 story, The Scarlet Plague. Did you know that Jack London wrote science fiction? Well, he did. He wrote quite a bit of science fiction. Tell you the truth, I haven't read much of it. Yet today, he might very well be considered a science fiction writer, much in the way that Ray Bradbury or Kurt Vonnegut is considered science fiction. You know, a little good for one of those, but you gotta admit it, science fiction writer. In fact, the first money he ever received as a professional writer was for a story in the science fiction category, a story called A Thousand Deaths, which was published by the Black Cat in 1899. Oh, probably about 13 of his 188 published short stories, and 4 of the 22 novels fall quite clearly into the category of science fiction. And, of course, other stories contain fantastic elements. There are a number of ghost stories. His science fiction shows a clear influence of such horror fantasy writers as Mary Shelley, Edgar Allan Poe, and some of the more popular science fiction writers of the late 19th century. People like H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, H. Rider Haggard, and Stanley Waterloo. This adaptation by Escape, which first aired on April the 8th of 1954, does take considerable liberties with the story. The story takes place in 2073 and takes the form of a narration by an old man to his grandchildren of events that he witnessed 60 years earlier. Escape picks up the whole thing and transports it to 1950 San Francisco. It changes the tone into that of a tense disaster epic, and the focus is primarily on the main character and a handful of survivors trying to escape the collapse of civilization. Also, the original story ends on a kind of hopeful note. The Escape adaptation certainly did not. Still, the Escape screw adaptation is an interesting one and worth 30 minutes of your time.
Tired of the everyday grind? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all? We offer you Escape. Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure. Desolation, looking down on what was once a great city, while coming slowly to meet you, her hand stretched out in greeting to you, is a beautiful girl whose very existence may be the cause of your death. Listen now as Escape brings you Jack London's classic novel, The Scarlet Plague.
I am recording this only for myself.
for my own sanity. Perhaps even from some age-old sense of duty. For I have not the slightest hope that it will ever be heard by any living human being. I was at one time a professor of English literature in the great university at San Francisco. Professor James Smith, a man who believed in reason and intellect, and who abhorred the instincts of animal nature. But that was before the terror and the madness of the Scarlet Plague. This morning I killed a sheep with my bare hands. Then, squatting on the ground, I tore a haunch from my prey and ate it raw. It began simply on a Monday morning, as I recall. I was having breakfast at the counter in the campus cafeteria with Bill Dombey of the physiology department. He was glancing over the front page of the morning paper.
I don't know why I do it, Jim.
Do what?
Buy a paper every morning. Nothing changes but the date. Senator so-and-so back in Washington after whirlwind tour, love nest killing in Omaha. New bomb test at Inuwatok scheduled.
What's that item down at the bottom?
Where?
Down the corner. New York fights Scarlet Plague.
Some news reporter's pipe dream, I suppose. Nine persons have died since last evening of a strange malady which has left doctors at Manhattan hospitals admittedly baffled. The disease, if it is a disease, strikes without warning and slays its victim in less than an hour. Apparently, the first symptoms are a feeling of well-being and lightheadedness, accompanied by a slight rise in temperature. A few minutes later, a fiery red rash appears on the hands and face and spreads rapidly over the entire body. Within 10 to 30 minutes, the victim goes into coma and dies.
Ridiculous.
There's no disease that acts like that. It's food poisoning, something of that sort.
Please, Bill, I'm eating.
Medical authorities are unanimously agreed, however, that no general danger exists and that there is no cause for public concern or alarm, which is double talk, for we don't know what it is yet.
What about a mutation?
Mutation of what?
Well, how do I know? You're the physiologist.
Oh, you're talking about those scare stories, I suppose. Harmless virus or bacteria mutates and throws down some new deadly type. Antibiotics won't touch it. Medical science helps. A million people wiped out overnight.
It's a possibility, isn't it?
Oh, Jim, bacteria strains are always mutating. And usually the mutation is less harmful than the parent. That idea has been overworked for years. Pass the cream, please.
Oh. Bill?
Hmm?
Is it a possibility or not?
Yes. It's a possibility. Jim, that rook's the only piece you can move, and you know it.
Don't rush me now. We still got the queen back here. Now let's see.
And here is the latest development on the Scarlet Plague.
No,
the following statement was released a few minutes ago.
I wouldn't move that if I were you.
Bureau of Public Health. Up to this hour, the official death toll in Greater New York is 321 persons. In Boston, 94. Washington, D.C., 111. Chicago, 181. Medical
spreading like wildfire, yeah.
Working around the clock. It is expected momentarily that the causative agent of the disease will be isolated and an effective treatment prescribed. Meanwhile, stay out of crowds, stay home, and stay calm. We return you now to Dance Time.
Turn it off, Jim. How can it spread so fast?
It's hard to tell, not knowing the period of incubation, whether it's airborne, contagious by contact, how long it's contagious before the symptoms show up, not even knowing what it is, in fact. One thing's sure, though, something's got to be done fast.
I guess we can call ourselves lucky out here. There hasn't been a case reported in San Francisco.
No. Not yet. When all the breathers of this world are dead, you still shall live. Such virtue hath my pen, where breath most breathes, even in the mouths of men. Now, I did not choose this particular sonnet because of possible contemporary suitability, but because it does, I think, best keynote the transitional phase that later appears in the philosophies and the poetic... Is something wrong back there?
Mr. Smith!
Yes, what's the trouble, Miss Baxter?
Look at his face! It's the Scarlet Plague!
Now wait! Morley, Everett, wait and give me a hand here. Miss Wilson.
Mr. Smith, look at my hands. My arms all red.
Now, Miss
Wilson. I feel so strange. Cold and numb. I'm dying. Everyone who gets it dies. I'm only 19 and I'm dying.
There.
When all breathers of this world are dead, you...
Now, in San Francisco. Sat for a long time in the empty classroom, paralyzed by shock, by a strange fear I'd never felt before, the fear of the unknown. The girl had walked into my class smiling and talking, and now she lay dead at the back of the room. Why? How could it happen so suddenly? What had caused the plague? Where had the terror started? And where would it end? I went to the faculty club. Bill Dombey was listening to the latest report.
News reports from around the nation include the following figures: greater than 1,000 deaths. Philadelphia estimated 150,000 deaths. Chicago, one moment, please. A bulletin has just been handed to me from the Scarlet Plague is raging Europe. Unofficial reports from Russia estimate the death toll in Moscow at 180,000, with additional millions dead and dying throughout the summer. They are received for as long as our facilities be.
No word of any cure yet?
Jim, I didn't hear you come in.
I just walked across the campus. It's completely deserted.
Yeah. Just the faculty club here is the only holdout. And at that, there are only four.
Four?
Counting you, Myra Blake of Graphic Arts. She went over to her room to pack some keepsakes. She'll be back. Dr. Barnes is out in the kitchen trying to rustle up something to drink.
Bill, that girl who died in my class a while ago, one minute she was all right, and a minute later she was dead.
Well, it's fast, that's one thing.
Can you get it from contact? I lifted her head. I put some books under it.
Nobody knows how you get it. I don't suppose contact matters much. It couldn't be all contact. Not millions of cases.
8 hours. Find a cure. They've had 2 days now. What are they all doing?
Dying, Jim, like everybody else.
Dombey, Smith.
Oh, Dr. Barnes.
Here. Maybe this will help.
Scotch.
Why not? The whole case of it out there. I think it might be a good idea to keep that radio on.
Yes, you're probably right, Dr. Barnes. Technicians, engineers, they've died by thousands all over the country. How much longer can services like radio, telephone, transportation...
Minutes ago. All conveyances, regardless of ownership or occupancy, are being stopped and turned back at Army control points. Stay where you are. Do not attempt to travel. You are no safer in one place than in another. The plague is everywhere. Repeat.
It won't stop, and no, they'll still try to run.
Yes, anywhere, just as long as it's somewhere else. The Army has not mutinied. Repeat, the Army has not mutinied.
It must be getting rough out there.
Signed by Edmund C. Dover, Senate member and acting President of the United States. and by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In a bulletin just handed to me, Johns Hopkins regretfully states that Dr. Theodore von Quickler, who had earlier announced partial success in identifying the causative agent of the plague, has just died. So Dr. Quickler left no notes on his work. Hospital personnel continued to...
What happened to the lights? Power failure, I guess. It was bound to happen sooner or later.
There's a flashlight in that desk drawer.
I got it.
There is a portable radio with batteries in the game room.
Oh, let's leave it for the moment, Dr. Bond.
Yes, the liquor sounds better than the news.
Well, in that case, I wonder what's keeping Miss Blake. She was coming right back.
Hey, wait a minute.
Hmm?
Where's that light coming from?
Looks like a fire. Maybe we can see from the window.
Not one fire, a thousand fires.
Down there, toward the bay. Berkeley, Oakland, and over in the city. Why? What started them?
Open! Can't you hear why, Jim?
Gunfire.
Yes. They're not waiting for the plague to do the job.
No. They're already out in force. The looters, the maimers, the robbers, people with a hate and a grievance.
If it started already, it'll get a lot worse.
Oh, yes. It'll get worse.
We stood at the window of the faculty club, looking out across the campus, down over the hills toward the bay, where fires lit up the growing night, and where even fiercer fires of greed and lust and hate burned in hearts that were beating their last hours or even seconds of life in this world. For a world was dying at our feet, and though we had so far been spared, we knew we too were dying with it.
Contact is still being maintained with Buenos Aires. And since London overseas went silent a few minutes ago, this is now our only contact outside continental North America.
It makes you know you're alone.
We are at present able
really
to maintain
alone.
Contact with only two stations in this country, Washington and Chicago. The West Coast has been silent for some 30 minutes, and we do not know whether we are being heard there at this time.
This is unbelievable.
At the moment, we are waiting for word from Washington naming the new president of the United States to replace Edmund C. Dover, who died on the Senate platform while attempting to conduct...
What's the use?
Well, are we still agreed on leaving?
We must. If by some miracle we do survive, we'll be out of food here in 3 days. And tonight may be the last chance to find any. Probably looting every store in the Bay Area.
Grocery stores, liquor stores, jewelers, fur shops.
More the reason to get started now, then.
Right. If we can make 3 or 4 trips to the station wagon tonight, we ought to be set here for quite a while. What about those pistols, Dr. Barnes? You said there were a couple in the safe.
Yes, I'll get them.
Funny how things are changing. He was chancellor of this university. Now he's foraging for food.
Yes, well, I'll gas up the station wagon and get it over here so we can...
Is anybody here?
Well, Jim, turn that flashlight on the door.
Myra.
Jim, thank heaven you're still here.
Oh, Dr. Barnes was worried about you, Myra. He just went into the other room. I'll tell him you're here.
All right, Jim. I was afraid there might not be anybody here. I was hurrying to get back, and I caught my heel on the edge of the walk and fell. I think I hit my head.
Tripped and fell. The whole world dying, and you trip and fall.
I guess it is funny.
Myra? Bill?
What is it?
What's wrong?
Dr. Barnes is lying just outside. Dead.
Plague?
Yes. But he got the pistols.
Thanks. Do you know how to use one of these, Jim?
In a general way. Well, we'd better get started, Bill. We shouldn't be too long, Myra.
You're not going to leave me here alone.
Well, she's right, Jim. I wouldn't want to be left alone either.
All right. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
tried the Oakland docks first, the big food warehouses along the railroad tracks. It was a dead end. From a mile away, we could see the blaze towering into the night sky. The whole dock area was in flames. We swung the station wagon back onto the ramp and headed across the Bay Bridge toward the city itself, fighting our way in and out of the jumbled traffic and the terrified crowds on foot, turning and twisting among the dead and dying.
You better go back, Bill. This is getting worse every block.
Yeah, I know. Trying to get a chance to turn around.
There's an alley there by the hotel. Maybe you can edge in there.
Worth a try, anyway.
Look out, Bill!
Hey, what were you bumbling into?
Sorry.
I ain't taking a pusher out from nobody. Not anymore, you understand?
I told
That's
you
on
I
was... kind of what I got. You take a look at a 45, wise guy.
Oh, careful, Bill. He's drunk.
Look close and you can see the bullet coming out. Watch that.
I bet he's doing all right. I bet he got a real good look at
him. He's crazy, Myra. Come on, hurry. We've got to get out of here.
What about the other man?
We'll leave the car. Come on, out this side. This way, Myra. The hotel entrance. Out of the way. One side. Left the car. All right, come on.
What can we do, Jim? They saw us come in. They'll be after us any second.
The stairway there, next to the elevator. Hurry, Myra. Maybe we can find a room, some place to hide in case they come up the stairs.
Try that one, Jim.
All right.
Hey,
look! They've got more guests.
Sorry.
Go on in and live. That's what all of us are doing. Living while we're dying.
Harding.
Go on in. We got plenty to eat, plenty to drink. 50 pounds of diamonds, tons of money, lots of women, and not a worry in the world.
Come on, Myra, let's go.
Go ahead. Come on, let me open another bottle.
Another time. Jim, where can we go?
Well, the hotel's about 12 or 14 stories high. The elevators aren't working. I doubt if anybody'd bother us on one of the top floors. They wouldn't have any reason to climb up there. You want to try it?
All right, Jim.
Let's go. For 5 days, we stayed on the top floor of the hotel. And no one came up to bother us. Twice, with pistol in hand, I left Myra in the room and slipped down into the streets to forage for food and supplies. Gradually, over the 3 days, I saw the mobs diminish, thin out, as the Scarlet Plague continued to rage unchecked. And finally, on the morning of the 6th day, I brought Myra down from the room to see what had happened to the city.
There's not a person in sight, Jim. No one but us. Not another living soul as far as you can see.
Listen. Another sound.
A dead world. There must be others, Jim. Not just us. They're hiding. We'll take a car and drive and look for them. There must be others.
But she was wrong. We drove for 100 miles, all over the city and the countryside around it. And when we finally stopped on a hill above the bay, we knew that there was not another living soul in the whole city. We were the only human beings left alive in San Francisco. And most likely the only one in the entire world.
But why, Jim? Why us and no one else?
That's,
I don't know why. I don't know why any of this. Just too vast to begin to comprehend. But we're alive. That's the only thing that's certain. We're both alive. To be alone, to be the only living human in the world, would mean terror. Absolute terror and insanity.
I feel guilty somehow. Being alive when everyone else is dead.
Can't be any guilt when you don't have a choice. It was nothing we did. And besides, Myra, don't you see what it means? Since we've been spared, mankind itself has been spared, and civilization. We'll have children. We'll teach them. See that they remember and pass on the greatness of the past.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Together. Together we can do it. We can give mankind another chance. You and I, Myra, we can keep it from being lost forever. Together, everything is different. There's a new hope, something to live for and work for. And we...
What's wrong, Jim?
Myra.
What?
Your face. It's turning scarlet.
Under the direction of Norman McDonald, Escape has brought you The Scarlet Plague by Jack London, specially adapted for radio by Les Crutchfield, starring Vic Perrin. Featured in the cast were Parley Bear, Greg, and John Daner, with Eleanor Tannen, John Larch, Barney Phillips, and Sam Edwards. Your announcer, George Walsh. The special music for Escape is composed and conducted by Leith Stevens.
If you're interested, I'm going to include a few links over at the webpage, www.nighttransmissions.com. Among these will be a link to a LibriVox reading of the original short story. This short story really is too long to include in this show as a whole, due to the fact that it's nearly 2 hours long, and I think that's a bit much, and so it just doesn't really fit the format. Also, the book is available in public domain at the Gutenberg Project, and I will include a link to the download page for this book at the Gutenberg Project. To find this, as I said, just go to www.nighttransmissions.com. Make sure that you're looking for the notes for show 97 and go down the page until you find the section for segment 3. It'll all be there.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call the Kidnap Caper. I was shocked to learn that a wealthy industrialist named Quigley had been kidnapped. Mrs. Quigley asked me to investigate when she received a strange ransom note in her husband's handwriting. It said to have their son, John, bring $200,000 in small bills to a nearby park at 10 o'clock that night. But we don't have a son named John, Mrs. Quigley told me. Very interesting, I said. I believe Mr. Quigley's trying to tell us something. In a moment, I'll tell you what.
Yeah, you got it. This is a break. And we'll be back real soon.
In the case of the kidnap caper, the note mentioned a son, John, who didn't exist. I had a hunch the letters J-O-H-N were a code corresponding to numbers. The phone number where Quigley was held. The hunch was right.
Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Dear Harold, I have at last realized that you will be happier without me. I do not blame you, so you must not blame yourself for my action. We are told this is the coward's way, but I feel I am acting not out of weakness, but out of strength. All the strength I can muster. Love, Susan.
Theater 5 presents To Be or Not to Be, Maybe.
I'm acting not out of weakness, but out of strength. All the strength I can muster.
Reading it again. You had to read it again. It's been over a year, but every time there's an argument, you have to read it. You're sorry I bungled it. You're really sorry, aren't you?
Oh, please, Sue. Now, you know that's not true. Now, let's not go into all of it again.
Then why do you always take that out and read it? Why do you keep it?
Hoping, I guess, that it will remind you of that horrible experience. I guess I'm afraid you might try again.
You're afraid of nothing of the sort. You'd love me to try again, but you know I won't. Then I thought I didn't care about my life. Well, now I care. My life, such as it is, matters to me. Oh, I know you're dying for your freedom, but I'm not dying to give it to you. And not by divorce, either.
I never asked for a divorce.
Oh, but if you thought it would do you any good, you'd ask quick enough. You wish you could just give me 2 weeks' notice like some employee at your office. You hate my inefficiency, and you never stop telling me. You don't want a wife, you want an office manager.
Oh, why can't you understand that all I want is an end to this constant fighting?
You think I enjoy it?
Well, you seem to. Whatever we talk about ends up in an argument.
I don't start them.
Susan, when I came home this evening, I asked if you'd like to go out to dinner. And you accused me of making a crack about dinner not being ready. Now, I don't know what you call that, but I call it starting an argument.
Oh, don't play Mr. Innocent with me. In everything you do and everything you say, there's a hidden criticism of me. And not always too hidden. You didn't want to take me out for dinner. You were making a crack and you know it. And doing it in a way to make me appear unreasonable. You do it over and over.
Susan, please. Now, without any hidden meaning, and as simply as I know how to say it, can't we accept the fact that our marriage didn't turn out to be the love of the century,
You can say that again.
But as long as we're living together, can't we at least try to live with some small degree of peace and quiet? Perhaps even hope to enjoy a moment together now and then.
I try all the time. For days, I beg for us to go to Vermont for a weekend of skiing. Just a simple weekend in Vermont. Some people fly to Rome for a weekend, to Paris just for dinner. But I asked for a little weekend in Vermont, and I've had to listen to you tell me I'm unreasonable.
Still twisting it to suit your purpose. That is not what I said.
You did. Even tonight. Since you walked through that door tonight, you've said at least 10 times that I'm unreasonable.
All right, make it 11. You're unreasonable. Oh, why not make it an even dozen? You are unreasonable.
Try to enjoy a few moments together, you said. Then calling me unreasonable merely because
Not because you want to go to Vermont. Now, there's nothing unreasonable about wanting to go skiing. But it is unreasonable to keep going on and on about it when I've told you I can't spare the time right now.
So easy, isn't it? You don't want to go, so you say you can't spare the time.
I can't.
Then you make me the villain because I don't meekly give in.
Now, I've explained to you why I can't...
Oh, you've explained nothing. I'd be interested in an explanation of why you're so busy you can't get away for a weekend. I have a fairly good idea, but I'd like to hear it. Go ahead, explain it.
Can't you talk without shouting?
No, because I don't get through to you.
Look, do you want the neighbors to think you're insane?
Oh, I don't care. Maybe I am sick. Sick of being told you're right and I'm wrong. Sick of complaints about my cooking, the way I run the house. Sick of being made to feel guilty every time I ask
you. Susan, stop it. All right, we'll go. You pack, get the car filled with gas, and we'll leave first thing in the morning.
I'm going out for a walk.
It's a fine arrangement for you. When things get too unpleasant at home, you come here. But what about me?
Darling, it's not as if I misled you. You were a friend of Susan's. You knew the situation. You accepted it.
I did, at first.
You mean you don't now?
I mean I don't enjoy sitting here waiting with open arms for you to have a fight with your wife.
You don't have to wait long. I'm here more than I'm home.
It's not the same.
Thank heaven it isn't. I love every minute I spend with you. I like to think you feel the same.
I do. But when you aren't here, when you're home, when I'm alone, I start realizing that we have no relationship. Not really. It's what the other woman must always realize in the end.
Ah, don't say that. You're not the other woman.
No? Then what am I?
The woman I love.
Do you? Where are you when I have a problem and need you? I can't come to you. What about the times that I don't feel well? I'm just plain lonely. I can't even call you.
Darling, I'm aware of that. And I don't like it either. I try to make it up to you.
You come here and complain to me about Sue, of how miserable you are. I'm expected to soothe you and baby you, like a little boy who got into a fight on the way home from school. I want to be a mother, but not that kind. I love you, Harold, but there's no future for us.
Perhaps if we go to Sue, if we explain, perhaps she'll give me a divorce.
Oh, you know better than that. We both do. Hello? Hello? Who is it? Who's there? Strange. There's no answer, but the line was open.
Oh, wrong number, probably.
Harold, do you think Sue could suspect us?
No, I'm sure not.
Well, at times recently I've wondered.
Well, if she did, we'd hear about it, believe me.
I'm not so certain. And just now, the telephone, I could almost sense her at the other end.
Oh, you imagined it. Perfectly natural under the circumstances. Now, forget it. Here, let me get you another drink.
No, I don't want one. I'm tired. I really think you ought to leave. Go home, please.
I can't leave you now. Not after the way you've been talking.
Staying another hour, 2 hours? What would that solve?
Well, I can't leave when you're upset. Laurie.
Yes?
Susan did try to take her life once. Remember?
Of course I remember.
Maybe she will again.
Harold, please. You're trying to hold on to me by holding out false hopes that somehow, some way, things will be different.
But she did try once. We don't know she won't.
Yes, we do. She had no intention of suicide. It was just another one of her sick tricks. She wanted to frighten you, make you sorry for her.
And it worked. I do feel sorry for her. She'll try again. I'll make sure she does.
Harold... What do you mean?
There are ways. I've thought about it. She'll try again. And want to or not, this time she'll succeed. This is the first drink I've enjoyed with you since, well, now let's think. It must have been our 5th anniversary. More than 2? No, nearly 2 years ago. I wish you could know what a pleasure it is. What a delightful change. To sit here and have my martini. Leave my 6th martini in peace and quiet. And to know that at long last, this is one evening when you won't end up fighting. You never realize my hatred for fighting, for any sort of violence. Oh, if you could but know what I've planned for you, I think you would actually be proud of me. But I'm afraid you won't know. I'm afraid my loving wife has had too many of my very special martinis. All right. There's only one thing to do, and I think it's time to do it. Take you to the garage and let you sleep it off. A long, long sleep.
Up we go.
I hate to say it, my love, but you're heavier than when I carried you across the threshold. But I didn't carry you, did I? No, I remember we thought it too corny. Well, maybe that's where we made our first mistake. People like us shouldn't fear being corny. Now, down you go. Ah, let's see. A bit more to the side. Ah, perfect. Slumped in the front seat exactly as I found you before. Well, your note. Your sweet, thoughtful suicide note. It was that one line you wrote. I have at last realized you will be happier without me. You see, my dear, it proves that with a little effort, two people, even two people like us, can find something upon which they can agree. There's no question but that you were completely right. I shall be much happier without you. Now, the hose through the window. Now to connect it. Sorry if I'm slow, but I haven't had your experience at this sort of thing. There now. The keys. Put them in the ignition and turn them. Have a pleasant trip. Darling wife. Bon voyage to the undiscovered country. The undiscovered country from which no traveler returns. And that's the whole story. Now, Glory, let's drink to our future together.
Don't you think you've had enough to drink? It isn't going to be easy for you. You'll need a clear head.
My head has never been clearer.
I don't know how you can be so calm after... Well, after...
Don't be afraid. Say it. Murder. Now, frankly, I'm surprised, too, but there is something very sobering about murder.
Now, let's go over it all again. Maybe there's something important you overlooked.
I don't want to keep talking about it. I've thought of everything. Drink your drink and please stop worrying.
What about an autopsy? Wouldn't they find traces of the sleeping powder or whatever it was?
There's not likely to be one. There's the suicide note written in her handwriting, and there's the record of her previous attempt. It's natural for such a person to try again. There's no reason for suspicion.
Even so, there could be an autopsy.
It wouldn't matter. The drug was prescribed by her doctor and purchased by her from our druggist.
But won't the police wonder why she didn't just take an overdose?
They might. But I doubt if she'll be able to tell them. But the record will show she tried this route before.
But why the drug first?
Well, if it were you, wouldn't you rather be drowsy and falling asleep than just sit there smelling the carbon monoxide?
I suppose.
There's your answer. Darling, you must believe me. I thought of all these things.
Won't the police wonder where you've been during the past 2 hours since you had a drink with her?
Probably.
Well, what will you tell them?
The truth. That I was here. She and I got into an argument. I left and came over here until she had a chance to calm down. You know, darling, you're beginning to sound like a district attorney.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. But if you plan to use me as an alibi to involve me, then I think
I'd... Laurie, you're already involved. I did it for you. Now, let's please stop talking about what's been done and start making plans for ourselves.
We can't. Not now.
Why not? Now we'll be free to marry. Not right away, of course, but in a few months. Well, that's what you wanted.
Not like this. I didn't think you'd... Well...
Murder my wife for it? Well, of course you did. We did everything but talk about it outright.
I knew you had it in mind, but I never thought you'd actually do it.
Well, you didn't leave me much choice.
Don't start blaming me.
Well, you made it clear that it was either get rid of her or get rid of me. I couldn't lose you, Laurie. You know how much you mean to me.
No, Harold, please don't. I have to think.
But I love you, Laurie.
You say that now. Maybe you may want to be free of me, just as with Sue. The same way, even.
Darling, how can you talk like that? I did what I did because I love you.
I heard it's easier the second time.
Oh, now, darling, you're just upset and don't realize what you're saying. Get some rest. It's time I should be returning to the apartment anyway.
Harold, I'm afraid.
Well, don't be. After I've reported it to the police and as soon as I know everything is going to be all right, I'll call you.
No, don't call. It may not be safe.
You're her friend, our friend. It's perfectly natural that I'd call you, just like I'll notify other people.
I guess you're right.
I know I'm right. Goodbye, darling.
Goodbye.
And try not to worry.
I'll try.
Susan? Who's there?
Mr. King?
What? Who are you? What are you doing here?
I'm sorry I frightened you.
Who are you? And where's my wife?
I'm Lieutenant Young. We found this note. It's addressed to you.
Let me see it. Oh, no. Susan, no, not again. Where is she, Lieutenant? I'm going to see my wife. Where is she?
Here I am, darling.
Susan, I thought that...
Oh, I know what you thought. But as you can see, you were mistaken.
I'm afraid I don't understand, but...
No, I'm sure you don't. But it's really quite simple. Oh, please don't think it was your fault. You were very clever, as always. And your plan was obviously thought out carefully and logically. However, your bungling wife merely bungled again.
Bungled? How do you mean, bungled?
Remember when you told me to fill the car up with gas? Well, you know how stupid I am. You're always reminding me. I forgot to do it. The car only ran for a few minutes. It's difficult to make them run without gas. But at least you're not without me.
Correction, Mrs. King. I'd say he'll be without you for, well, if he's lucky, only 10 years.
Correction, Lieutenant. Only 10 years if he's unlucky.
To be, maybe. Written by Claude Travers and directed by Ted Bell. In the cast, Stan Watt, Arlene Walker, June Graham, and Jack Hurdle. Audio engineers Marty Folia and Neil Pope.
Toy Shop. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Xander Phillips. Toy Shop by Henry Maxwell Dempsey. The gadget was strictly, beyond any question, a toy. Not a real, workable device. Except for the way it could work under a man's mental skin. Because there were few adults in the crowd, and Colonel Biff Haughton stood over 6 feet tall, he could see every detail of the demonstration. The children, and most of the parents, gaped in wide-eyed wonder. Bill Haughton was too sophisticated to be awed. He stayed on because he wanted to find out what the trick was that made the gadget work. "It's all explained right here in your instruction book," the demonstrator said, holding up a garishly printed booklet open to a four-color diagram. "You all know how magnets pick up things, and I bet you even know that the Earth itself is one great big magnet. That's why compasses always point north. Well, the Atomic Wonder space wave tapper hangs onto those space waves. Invisibly, all around us, and even going right through us, are the magnetic waves of the Earth. The Atomic Wonder rides these waves just the way a ship rides on the waves of the ocean. Now watch." Every eye was on him as he put the gaudy model rocket ship on the table and stepped back. It was made of stamped metal and seemed as incapable of flying as a can of ham, which it very much resembled. Neither wings, propellers, nor jets broke through the painted surface, It rested on three rubber wheels, and coming out through the bottom was a double strand of thin insulated wire. This white wire ran across the top of the black table and terminated in a control box in the demonstrator's hand. An indicator light, a switch, and a knob appeared to be the only controls. "I turn on the power switch, sending a surge of current to the wave receptors," he said. The switch clicked, and the light blinked on and off with a steady pulse. Then the man began to slowly turn the knob. "A careful touch on the wave generator is necessary, as we are dealing with the powers of the whole world here." A concerted, "Ah," swept through the crowd as the space wave tapper shifted a bit, then rose slowly into the air. The demonstrator stepped back, and the toy rose higher and higher, bobbing gently on the invisible waves of magnetic force that supported it. Ever so slowly, the power was reduced, and it settled back to the table. "Only $17.95, the young man said, putting a large price sign on the table, "for the complete set of the Atomic Wonder, the Space Tapper Control Box, battery and instruction book." At the appearance of the price card, the crowd broke up noisily and the children rushed away toward the operating model trains. The demonstrator's words were lost in their noisy passage, and after a moment he sank into a gloomy silence. He put the control box down, yawned, and sat on the edge of the table. Colonel Houghton was the only one left after the crowd had moved on. "Could you tell me how this thing works?" the colonel asked, coming forward. The demonstrator brightened up and picked up one of the toys. "Well, if you'll look here, sir," he opened the hinged top. "You'll see the space wave coils at each end of the ship." With a pencil, he pointed out the odd-shaped plastic forms about an inch in diameter that had been wound, apparently at random, with a few turns of copper wire. Except for these coils, the interior of the model was empty. The coils were wired together, and other wires ran out through the hole in the bottom of the control box. Bill Houghton turned a very quizzical eye on the gadget, and upon the demonstrator, who completely ignored this sign of disbelief. "Inside the control box is the battery," the young man said, snapping it open and pointing to an ordinary flashlight battery. "The current goes through the power switch and the power light to the wave generator." "What you mean to say," Biff broke in, "is that the juice from this 15-cent battery goes through this cheap rheostat to those meaningless coils in the model, and absolutely nothing happens. Now tell me what really flies this thing. If I'm going to drop 18 bucks for 6 bits worth of 10, I want to know what I'm getting." The demonstrator flushed. "I'm sorry, sir," he stammered. "I wasn't trying to hide anything. Like any magic trick, this one can't really be demonstrated until it has been purchased." He leaned forward and whispered confidentially. "I'll tell you what I'll do, though. This thing is way overpriced and hasn't been moving at all. The manager said I could let him go for $3 if I could find any takers. If you want to buy it for that price..." "Sold, my boy," the colonel said, slamming 3 bills down on the table. "I'll give that much for it, no matter how it works. The boys in the shop will get a kick out of it." He tapped the winged rocket on his chest. "Now, really, what holds it up?" The demonstrator looked around carefully, then pointed. "Strings," he said. "Or, rather, a black thread. It runs from the top of the model, through a tiny loop in the ceiling, and then back down to my hand, tied to this ring on my finger. When I back up, the model rises. It's simple as that." "All good illusions are simple," the colonel grunted, tracing the black thread with his eye, "as long as there's plenty of flim-flam to distract the viewer." "If you don't have a black table, a black cloth will do," the young man said. "And the arch of a doorway is a good sight. Just see that the room and back is dark. Wrap it up, my boy. I wasn't born yesterday. I'm an old hand at this kind of thing." Bill Houghton sprang it at the next Thursday night poker party. The gang were all missile men, and they cheered and jeered as he hammed up the introduction. "Let me copy the diagram, Biff. I could use some of those magnetic waves in the new bird. Those flashlight batteries are cheaper than locks. This is the thing of the future." Only Ted Kaner caught wise as the flight began. He was an amateur magician and spotted the gimmick at once. He kept silent with professional courtesy and smiled ironically as the rest of the bunch grew silent one by one. The colonel was a good showman, and he had set the scene well. He almost had them believing in the space wave tapper before he was through. When the model had landed and he had switched it off, he couldn't stop them from crowding around the table. "A thread," one of the engineers shouted, almost with relief, and they all laughed along with him. "Too bad," the head project physicist said. "I was hoping that little space wave tapping could help us out. Let me try a flight with it." "Daddy Gainer first," Bill announced. "He spotted it while you were all watching the flashing lights, only he didn't say anything." Kaner slipped the ring with the black thread over his finger and started to step back. "You have to turn the switch on first," Biff said. "I know," Kaner smiled, "but that's part of illusion, the spiel and the misdirection. I'm going to try this cold first so I can get it moving up and down smoothly, then go through it with the whole works." He moved his hand back smoothly in a professional manner that drew no attention to it. The model lifted from the table, then crashed back down. The thread broke, Kaner said. You jerked it instead of pulling it smoothly, Biff said, and knotted the broken thread. Here, let me show you how to do it. The thread broke again when Biff tried it, which got a good laugh that made his collar a little warm. Someone mentioned the poker game. This was the only time that poker was mentioned or even remembered that night, because very soon after this, they found that the thread would lift the model only when the switch was on, and 2.5 volts flowing through the joke coils. With the current turned off, the model was too heavy to lift. The thread broke every time. I still think it's a screwy idea, the young man said. 1 week getting fallen arches demonstrating these toy ships for every brat within 1,000 miles. Then selling the things for $3 when they must have cost at least $100 apiece to make. But you did sell the 10 of them to the people who would be interested, the older man asked. I think so. I caught a few Air Force officers and a colonel in missiles one day. Then there was one official I remembered from the Bureau of Standards. Luckily, he didn't recognize me. Then those two professors you spotted from the university. Then the problem is out of our hands and into theirs. All we have to do now is sit back and wait for the results. What results? These people weren't interested when we were hammering on their doors with the proof. We've patented the coils and can prove to anyone that there's a reduction in weight around them when they're operating. But a small reduction, and we don't know what's causing it. No one could be interested in a thing like that. A fractional weight decrease in a clumsy model? Certainly not enough to lift the weight of the generator. No one wrapped up in massive fuel consumption, tons of lift and such, is going to have any time to worry about a crackpot who thinks he found a minor slip in Newton's laws. You think they will now? The young man asked, cracking his knuckles impatiently. I know they will. The tensile strength of that thread is correctly adjusted to the weight of the model. The thread will break if you try to lift the model with it. Yet you can lift the model after a small increment of its weight has been removed by the coils. This is going to bug these men. Nobody's going to ask them to solve the problem or concern themselves with it, but it will nag at them because they know this effect can't possibly exist. They'll see at once that the magnet wave theory is nonsense, or perhaps true. We don't know. But they will all be thinking about it and worrying about it. Someone's going to experiment in his basement, just as a hobby, of course, to find the cause of the error. And he or someone else is going to find out what makes those coils work, or maybe a way to improve them. And we have the patents. Correct. They will be doing the research that will take them out of the massive lift propulsion business and into the field of pure spaceflight. And in doing so, they will be making us rich, whenever the time comes to manufacture, the young man said cynically. We'll all be rich, son, the older man said, patting him on the shoulder. Believe me, you're not going to recognize this old world 10 years from now. End of Toy Shop by Henry Maxwell Dempsey. Recording by Xander Phillips.
Well, that's it for tonight, folks. Thanks for hanging in there with me. I do appreciate it. And before I go, I do want to once again tell you how to get in touch with me. The principal way would be to just drop by the Night Transmissions website, which is www.nighttransmissions.com. There is no space or underscore or anything between the night and the transmissions. It's just one word, Night Transmissions. Another way to get in touch with me is just to write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. And oh yeah, there is a third way, a more modern way, a telephonic way. You see, I've also got a G-Voice number for Night Transmissions. Mostly it's just a place to leave a message, but I guarantee you the message will get to me, and if you say something interesting enough, it might even get on the air. I'd like that. I'd like for you to participate a little bit more. You know, a little bit of labor outsourcing. A little more work for you, a little less work for me. Anyway, the phone number is 541-995-0594. Like I said, that's it for now, so thank you, and I'll see you next week, I hope.